Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to the show live every Thursday at 11 on heritageradionetwork.org or download the podcast on iTunes. Today, my guest is an artist I've admired for many years, Frances Palmer. I first discovered her work through one of my personal and professional idols, Dominique Browning, when I was working for her at House and Garden. I will never forget the first time she showed me Frances's pottery. I was blown away by how detailed her work was and the degree to which I felt her hand and presence in the work. Her pottery feels wonderfully handmade, but maintains such a level of sophistication. So it's no surprise that she's built a devoted following of buyers, gallerists, and collectors well beyond her studio in Connecticut. I'm so excited to learn more about Frances, so let's get started. Frances, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Hey, thank you for coming all the way down from Connecticut this morning. I always like to start at the very beginning for interviews. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up in New Jersey, in Morristown, New Jersey, which is a beautiful Revolutionary War town. So we were always surrounded by incredible history. There was a great sculpture of George Washington, and George Washington's winter headquarters were just down the road from me. And I went to George Washington Elementary School. So I would walk to school every day. I'm the youngest of four, three older brothers.
Oh, wow.
And it was beautiful farm country. I know sometimes New Jersey doesn't get the best reputation, but where we grew up, it was dairy farms and vegetable farms and great farm stands kind of long before the eat local. Yeah. It was just sort of what we did. Mm-hmm. And but yet we were only an hour away from New York City. So my mom, since I was the only girl, she would drag me into the museums. And I just remember going to the Met, and she would take me to the ballet. So we would do a lot of things in the city. So I very early became comfortable with the Met and seeing paintings and just, you know, loving art.
That's amazing. So what were your parents like? Did they encourage you to create art of your own? Or was it more about sort of exposing you to the
I think it was a combination of both. I remember distinctly being taken to art lessons. And my dad was very creative. He was in advertising and did a lot of conceptualizing him. So we were all very kind of encouraged to do things. And I always gravitated toward the art and always took art lessons during elementary school and high school. And in fact, planned to go to art school. I'd gotten into Carnegie Mellon for printmaking, and I was all set to go there. But then by some fluke, I'd gotten into the Georgetown School of Foreign Service as well.
Wow, and not bad choices to have there, Frances.
this was, you know, quite a number of years ago. And for some reason, I went down the more academic route and in Washington, D.C., stumbled on all the different museums in the mall. And I just said, I must do art history. So I transferred to Barnard in New York City and finished up at Barnard and then went on to get a master's in art history from Columbia.
Wow, that's incredible. Did you have a favorite museum in D.C. when you were there?
I love the Freer with the Peacock Room. the Hirshhorn had just opened. I mean, it was a very, very exciting time, the Renwick. I mean, everything there is just fantastic. But again, I loved being in New York City because you could do the art history and then you could just go right into the museums and look at the work. And
what was that transition like going from D.C. to New York?
Very different cities, but I'd been in New York all my life, so it wasn't a big change. I liked the scale of New York. I mean, I liked the scale of D.C., and I could drive my bike everywhere. I lived in Georgetown, but you could bike downtown and lock your bike up everywhere. But I don't know. I found a little apartment in the West Village, and I would commute from the West Village up to Columbia, and I mean, New York is so fantastic. So
that sounds like an amazing way to go to school.
It was really fun.
An apartment in the village, no big deal. Going up to Barnard. Do you remember the first time that you had a meaningful experience with pottery or a particular artist in that field?
I think the thing that really sort of set me on my path to making ceramics is when I discovered the Omega Workshop and Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant and Roger Fry, where they all this, as I'm sure you know, this whole group of artists came together in London and in a farmhouse called Charleston outside of London right around World War I. And they had this concept to make every aspect of their life. So they did the paintings on the wall, but they painted the walls, and they set up a little pottery, and they made all the ceramics that they used to eat on. And then they painted the ceramics. And there's just something so magical about their hand on the ceramics that completely captivated me, and I always felt that that was something I would like to try.
Do you remember your first attempt at pottery, and what did you make?
I made some bowls, and it wasn't as horrible as it might have been, because, you know, as I said, I'd always done a lot of printmaking. I've always loved to cook. I mean, I'm a very kind of hands person, so there was just something so I connected with it immediately and just sort of just threw myself into doing it.
When, or was there a moment, or do you remember the time when you decided this was something you're going to pursue as a serious career?
Yeah, I do. I got married, we were living in New York, and then we moved out to Connecticut when our daughter was born. And I was completely unprepared for being a mother. I'd never seen a baby in my life, truly. And she was born. We brought her home on Christmas Day. We were living in Connecticut. I didn't know anybody. It was in the middle of nowhere, dead of winter. My husband would take off every day and be gone commuting to New York. And I said, okay, I've got to pull myself together here and figure something out to do. And I'd always worked. And it just didn't seem right for me not to be working and making things with my hands. Mm-hmm. So my husband said, well, why don't you try something you've always wanted to do? And I said, I've always wanted to try ceramics. So I signed up at the Art Guild in New Canaan, Silver Mine Art Guild, and took a throwing class. And it just, you know, I said, okay, this I can do. I can do this. So I went out and I found a used kiln and a wedging table for $25, which is what I still use today, wedging table.
Wow.
And a wheel. And I just, because the Art Guild was working in that kind of very 60s stoneware, heavy glazes, and mm-hmm. I wanted to do the Omega Workshop. So I had to figure out how to do the white earthenware and how I can paint it and everything. So I just kept doing it till
So did you just teach yourself?
I taught myself.
That's
yeah.
incredible. Yeah. Were there books or people that you were turning to for any
mostly
advice?
Books, mm-hmm. mostly books. And because of the art history background, I was really, you know, I loved the research. So I just kept plugging away.
One of the things I love so much about your work and sort of the context that I've seen your work mentioned, especially in sort of contemporary design, is in relation to gardening and to plants.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when I think of your name, I immediately think of a dahlia, because that's such a strong right. image in all of your product photography. How does sort of gardening and flowers in particular play a role in your work or in the inspiration for it?
Well, the first 10 years that we lived in Connecticut, we lived in this great kind of 40s glass house, but it was set into a hillside and it really wasn't set up. I did a lot of rock wall gardening. Mm-hmm. Then almost like 18 or 19 years ago, we moved to an old house with flat land that had a garden already set up. And I had just been reading through books and I saw a photo of this particular kind of flower and said, what is this flower? This I must have. And realized that it was a dahlia. And then I just, again, went on this whole research extravaganza of like, okay, I must grow every single dahlia, but not yellow ones. You know, I do like white, red, pink, orange. I don't ever gravitate too much to the yellow for some reason. But anyway, so I just started growing these flowers that were at the time very much out of vogue. You know, people mm-hmm. didn't People didn't think dahlias were cool. But now,
what was in vogue at that time?
You know, I'm just trying to, I guess, I really couldn't even say, because I always come to these things kind of from my own direction. Yeah. So it wasn't like, oh, I want to do this. It's just I saw something that appealed to me, and yes, then I just pursued it. This garden began to function for me, which it does now, as a way for me to grow the flowers that I use in my pots, mm-hmm, and on my table, and just have a kind of a unified vision of my work.
Yes. I love that sort of holistic approach you have to the work that you create, that you're thinking about all of the pieces that get used on a tabletop, but you're bringing in inspiration from so many different sources. And I think I was watching an interview with you when I was preparing for this. I think it was the very old school Martha Stewart television, mm-hmm, interview, which is fantastic. And you were talking about the importance of tabletop. And to me, when I think of someone creating things that go on a tabletop, it's so intrinsically tied to the idea of gathering and entertaining and being with the people that you love. How does that sort of play into what you do?
Well, I think the key about having people is make sure that it's not fussy. You know, and so in thinking about that, like, nothing has to match. And if somebody has one dish for me and dishes from, you know, somewhere else, that the point is that you just want to get things on the table so that people can just sit down and have a great time. And I think that people are so well informed now, and you know, nobody's afraid to go out on the road and whack off a weed and stick it in a, you know, no, but it's true. I mean, there's so no rules anymore, and I just think that that's perfect. I think it's great, because the point is that you want to bring people around the table and, mm-hmm, have a good time and have it be fun.
I love that. And there's your work is so, so beautiful, and in some ways so sophisticated and delicate, but there are so many pieces of it that work for sort of everyday life.
Right.
And I love that you did an expansion, and you have a collection called the Francis Palmer Pearl Collection that you did with Niagara Ceramics, which is based in Buffalo, and they're a 100-year-old company.
Yeah, well, the 1901 they started. Wow. Yeah.
And they are, I think, are employee-owned as well,
they are,
right?
Employee-owned.
How did you decide to sort of branch out into working with a factory, even though they're not sort of a typical factory?
Well, I had gotten to the point where I was making by hand dinner services for people, and as they were a little precious, because, mm-hmm, who could afford to order a 12 dinner? You know what I mean?
Entirely made
so
by hand.
So I just thought, wouldn't it be nice? And I think one day I had gone to the gift show at the Javits, and I was walking around looking at all the different companies and all the different lines, and it was like, wouldn't it be nice if I could maybe do something that I do, but on a more practical level? And many years ago, I'd gone to Turpin Sanders on Broadway down in Soho and gotten white Buffalo China dishes, which I'd used when my kids were growing up, and they were indestructible. And I had this idea, well, I'd like to do something American-made, and these are the only dishes I've ever used for my family. So I just picked up the phone, and I called them and said, I would like to manufacture my work in your company, and may I come talk to you? And they said, sure.
That's amazing. So you just looked them up in the phone book and gave them a call.
I just called them, and they had recently transitioned from being owned by the Oneida Corporation, becoming, mm-hmm, employee-owned. So it was just very good timing. So I flew up there in a snowstorm, and they said, well, we figured that anybody would come to Buffalo in February. And so we've worked together. I'm the only artist that they have ever partnered with.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are you still working with them today? Right?
We are working together.
That's incredible. And is that a collection that you're adding to, or sort of a...
Well, I hope to add to, but the truth of the matter is that we have a group of pieces that really kind of function, and they work. And I'm such a small facet of the factory that it's hard for me to be, you know, too demanding. I'm so unconventional, because it is a factory that does like a million dozen restaurant china pieces. Mm-hmm. And then because all of my prototypes were based on my hand-thrown shapes, they don't really fit through the automated machinery. So they are pressing everything and glazing everything by hand in the context of this massive operation. So
it's like you found a way to do handmade work.
I know,
in a factory.
I know. It's quite something. It's, I don't, yeah. And It's so durable. I mean, it doesn't chip, it doesn't crack, it goes in the oven. It's a very good everyday dish. But yet, sometimes if they're sitting on the table with some of my handmade work, you can't really tell the difference. Mm-hmm. So I'm really proud of it. I think the people that use it every day, I feel that there's such great quality there that it endures.
I love that. I love that you've been able to kind of mix in things that were more practical and that are slightly more affordable for people who are younger, starting out, and want to build a collection like that.
Yeah.
We're going to take a very quick break. And then when we come back, I want to ask you a question about a dinner party that is living in my head. So we're going to take a break and we'll be right back with Frances Palmer.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at WholeFoodsMarket.com/sharethebuzz.
Hey, welcome back to After the Jump. I'm your host, Grace Bonney, and today we're talking with artist and potter Frances Palmer. And before the break, we were talking about the way that gathering and entertaining play such a huge role in any artist's life that's focusing on sort of tabletop things and things that have to do with dinner. So I wanted to start this half of the interview by talking about what your ideal dinner party would be. And not just the food, but I want to know if you could have a dinner party with your work all over the table, who would be the guests that you would invite? And they could be anybody throughout history.
that's and on such short notice too.
Just really quickly, who's the
well? Okay, so I think the first thing I would say, my first ideal dinner party would be. I know this sounds so corny, but I have such wonderful friends, and I would love to have all my friends that I have. You know, I talk to all the time, and we get together, and we do have dinner parties, not as much as we used to, but it's really fun, and I love that. And sometimes just a buffet, so that people can serve themselves and wander around. Now the fantasy.
The fantasy guest.
Well, the first name that popped into my brain, if I could invite anybody who probably wouldn't want to come, would be like Van Gogh. I'd love to have Van Gogh.
Pre-ear, post-ear.
As I said, she probably wouldn't want to come. Yeah. There's a potter, Lucy Ree, you must know. I would love to have her. I'm just trying to think of all, like Daphne du Maurier, who wrote Rebecca. I'm just trying to think of all books that I would love. And I don't know. We'll just have to hold that thought.
That's a pretty good list. It makes me want to ask a little bit about, especially for, I mean, I know some artists.
Tolstoy.
You've got quite a dinner party going here. I love that you're talking about getting together with your friends. What sort of role do your peers and your friends play in your sort of artistic process or your support process? I know a lot of artists that are sort of just getting started out are now realizing the importance of having like a really strong friend group to keep them supported. Have you had a group like that?
I have had a great group of friends, especially a great group of women friends. Mm-hmm. And my women friends are all enormously talented and great entertainers, great cooks, you know, great. So they've been fantastic sounding boards, you know, some of my best customers. I mean, it's just, I feel really lucky that and the thing, you know, I have a daughter, we have a daughter and two sons, and they're in their, all in their 20s now. And, you know, I've taught them all to cook and entertain. So that, to me, is really rewarding when they call me up and they say, oh, you know, Mama, we just had a dinner party last night. We invited all these people in, you know. So I think that's the joy of what's happening now, is that it just sort of keeps moving outward. So I would say to a young person, yes, friendships, exchanges, it's so essential, especially, you know, as you get older, because you build history with people, and it's very meaningful.
I love that. I mean, it's not just inspiration, but it's very much a support system. And I love the way you have a great friendship and working relationship with Amy Merrick, who's one of mm-hmm. our Design Sponge alumni, who's an incredible florist and stylist. And I've loved to really watch that relationship grow. Did you have somebody that you looked up to in your sort of early stages of work that really inspired you, who was also an artist?
I think there wasn't anybody. A very good friend of mine is a jewelry designer named Linda Lee Johnson, and she lives down in D.C. And she was is an enormous mentor to me. She's, you know, always had her own business and enormously professional. Her work has been carried in Barney's for years. She's so elegant and has such great taste and style. My husband's sister, who actually I met Linda Lee through my sister-in-law, and she's 12, 13 years older than me, and she has been a great educator for me. Yeah, these older women have been enormously generous. And
that's fantastic. Yeah. What's some of the best advice you've gotten from somebody that you looked up to about your work and your career overall?
I think Linda Lee, as a jeweler, she said to me about my work, like I always would say, oh, how do I price it? You know, what do you think? She always said, just listen to yourself. And your ideas will come forward. You know, believe in what you're doing. And I think that's really true, because at the end of the day, no matter what, it's what you make has to speak for itself. So
I love that. I read an interview with you, I can't remember which one this was, where you talked about your inspiration and these ideas that you're bringing to the table, and you said that the clay can sense when you're not mentally present.
Oh, yeah.
And it made me want to think or talk more about your process. When you sit down to sort of start a piece, do you have an overall idea in mind, or do you kind of let the material speak to you?
I usually have a sketch of what I want to do. I work in a number of different clays, and each clay has its own personality. So if I sit down and work with porcelain, which is very challenging to throw with, I can have an idea and the clay can say, as if. And then, but with the earthenware, which is much more cooperative, you know, I can usually, losing my headphones, but I guess to answer your question, yes, I feel like I have to have a very clear mind of what I'm working towards.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your studio. What does it look like? What does it feel like? And what do you surround yourself with while you work?
Well, I'm very lucky. I have a great studio. When we moved to this other house, we found an old house frame, which my husband wanted to put up instead of doing new construction. So it's a huge old barn. And originally I was supposed to have only the first floor, but as things would have it, I sort of took over the whole place. So the first floor is where I have three wheels, one for the earthenware, one for terracotta, one for porcelain, and a couple of electric kilns and slab roller. You know, that's mm-hmm. where all my construction is done. And then the upstairs, which is kind of open up to the rafters, is where I move the work up and where I do all the packing and shipping. And the whole place is filled with light. And it's just, I'm very really lucky to have a place to go to every day. And then there's a little outbuilding where I have the gas kiln for the porcelain. And it's right next to the house, which is a good thing and a bad thing. So I can, you know, yeah. keep track of everything. But mm-hmm. also sometimes if I'm there, I pretty much work every day.
Tell us what an average day in the life of Frances Palmer is like.
Well, I try to get up in the morning. I love to get up early. I can just hear Stephen Orr making some funny comment about me. I used to hide my emails, like I will not send this email at 5:15, but I've just given up. Anyway, so as soon as it gets light, I have this great mutt named Peter, and he and I, we go for like a 3-mile walk, and then I come back, and then I'll go out to the studio and I'll start working. I'm a very much a morning person. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go probably to like 6 or 7, stop when I get tired, because then otherwise I just start to do things wrong.
You start to do things wrong. Do you listen to anything while you work? Do you listen to music?
Well, lots of times I like to listen to WFUV. I like to listen to music. Mm-hmm. But I listen to audiobooks a lot. That's why I was thinking about my dinner party, all mm-hmm. the people I like to listen to. And I also, for comfort, I tend to go listen to some of the same things again and again. So I have to steer myself away from that. But I love to listen to books on my iPod.
That's great. What role does collaboration play in your work? I've really loved watching you and Amy Merrick sort of do kind of photo shoots together with her flowers and her pottery.
She's so talented.
Are you continuing to sort of work with other people, whether or not it's actually making things together, but working together? Is collaboration a part of that?
I'm really starting to migrate in that direction more and more, because it's nice to be in my studio by myself, but it is nice. Like mm-hmm. one of the things I'm working on now is a collaboration with Chad Jacobs from Bone Simple Design, who is Stephen Orr's partner, mm-hmm. and we're doing a new lamp collection together. I've made the bases and he's doing the shades, mm-hmm. so that's really fun, and we're going to launch that shortly. And working with Amy and I've been talking with Emily Thompson about doing some work with her. So I'm definitely open to doing things. And as I told you a few moments ago, I'm going to go to China in May.
Tell us about that.
I know, I'm very excited. So I'm going to do an artist residency in Jindijian in China, which is a town about 500 miles southwest of Shanghai, where all the original royal porcelain mines are. And this residency has artists come from all over the world, and they give you a room in a studio, and then you go out and interface with all the different artisans. And, you know, it's very well known for blue and white, but also oxwood. I mean, I just think, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do there yet, but I'm really looking
For how long are you going to be there?
Well, they told me that the minimum amount of time one can go is a month.
Oh.
Yeah. So they say sometimes people come for 3 months. And then I've met people that have come and stayed there for a couple of years or go back and forth.
Wow.
So I think this is really the opening of a really exciting opportunity.
That's incredible. Are you going with any goals in mind? Or are you just going to kind of see what happens?
I have a few goals. There are some shapes that I've always wanted to be able to cast that I've never really know how to do. So I think there I have the opportunity to throw the shapes and then they can cast them. And I also want to work with the glazes, and I would like to explore the blue and white point of view with the blue oxides in the drawing and do huge washes. I mean,
I'm excited to see how this sort of expands what you're making when you get back. I'm very excited as a fan of your work to see how that changes.
Oh, thanks.
I think everybody's unique job, no matter what it is, whether you're the blogger or you're an artistic potter or you're a painter, really gives you an interesting view on what life is like. What do you think you have learned from working as a potter about life in general? Are there any lessons that have come from that particular field?
I think one of the thing that pops into my mind right away is patience and have the time to let things unfold. And maybe because I'm a little bit older now, that thing, sometimes you plant seeds for things, again, going back to the garden, and you think, oh, this is going nowhere. But sometimes it takes months, years, it's just never quite over. So you always have to try something. And if it doesn't come to you immediately, just know that it might eventually work out.
I love that. It's the complete opposite of what my life lesson from blogging has been, which is like, pick up the pace, move quickly. There's always a deadline. What advice do you have for up-and-coming artists or people who are thinking about approaching any form of ceramics?
Well, I think, which I might have said a little earlier, is you have to make what you believe. You can't worry about, oh, will somebody want this? Will somebody buy this? It has to come from you so genuinely. And then you have to make it with the hope that what your goal is for that work. I mean, you know, most of the work I make is functional. So my goal is that I want people to hold these pieces in their hand and live with them every day. But that might not be somebody else's goal. So whatever that particular thing that you're reaching for, you just have to do it as best you can and then hope that the other things will fall into place.
How hard is it to let the things go that you've made? I feel like you talk about these objects so lovingly, and I'm wondering is that a painful process to like then give them up to somebody who buys them?
No. I mean, I just love sending them out in the world. I really do. I do. And especially when I get emails or something or I see people and they say, oh, I use your cup every day, or, you know, I love this vase for these flowers. It's so rewarding. It just makes it all so worthwhile, because that, you know, I mean, I could hoard all of them, but that's not what I need.
You're a stronger woman than I am. I would feel the need to hoard those if I was making something so beautiful. Well, Frances, thank you so much for being here today. It's been a joy to
talk
to you.
Thank you so much.
And for everyone listening, you can visit Frances online at francespalmerpottery.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Thursday.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.